morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 17th of July. Very nice to have you with us. The Turbines playing us in. They're playing the Music Haven Concert Series tonight at Proctor's in Schenectady. We should note that the concert will be at the Series Rain site, which is Proctor's. It's musichavenstage.org, and they usually have it at their beautiful facility in downtown. But because of the rain, they're going to move inside, and the Turbines will be performing at Proctor's. So there you go. We'll have a playlist up, wamc.org/roundtable. Let me introduce the group to you this morning. We have a wonderful panel, and we welcome your letters and your thoughts. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo joins us. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you with us. Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith is here. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning.
Very nice. Good to see you. Hi.
Hiya.
You seem happy and ready. That's great. And when I think happiness, I think Times Union columnist Chris Churchill.
That's right. Yeah. Mr. Happy.
Mr. Happy. He's here. And the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert
Griffin.
That's
a happy title.
Yes. Real happy.
Super jovial.
Keeping us happy and alive, oddly. And WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan.
Well, good morning. We've only talked, you and I, three times this morning, but, you know, good morning again.
Well, good morning again. We catch up. We find out what's going on. And, well, it's a lovely group here. I want to get started and talk about what's going on in the world. So here's a question for the panel. Does the House vote yesterday, which condemns the president, mean anything?
Yes.
Okay. So with that in mind, I will tell you a little bit about the vote, and we'll see if everyone is in agreement with that. The House voted to condemn President Trump for his racist remarks regarding four freshman congresswomen. It was a divided House vote, which this came after the president told the four minority congresswomen to go back to their ancestral countries. All but a handful of Republicans dismissing the rebuke as a harassment, while many Democrats pressed their leaders for harsher punishment of the president. The imagery of the 240-187 vote was stark. A diverse Democratic caucus cast the president's words as an affront to millions of Americans and descendants of immigrants, while Republican lawmakers, the vast majority of them white men, stood with Trump against a resolution that rejected his racist comments that, quote, have legitimized fear and hatred of new Americans and people of color. That was the resolution. Trump insisted in a string of tweets Tuesday morning that he's not a racist. I don't have a racist bone in my body, he wrote. And the top two Republicans in Congress, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California, made identical statements when pressed on the president's remarks. They said the president is not a racist.
May not be a racist bone in his body, but certainly his brain, mouth, and heart seem to be. You know, well, I don't know what I think it's a sad moment, although I also will note that I read McCarthy's comment about this is a sad day for the House, which sort of fits in the insincere political bingo chart. It's up there with I need to spend more time with my family, and you're in my thoughts and prayers of sort of empty comments that are coming. You know, it's going to charge both bases, right? I mean, it's going to charge going to charge the GOP base, going to charge the Democrat base. I hope people who are watching this who haven't registered, or if they have family members who haven't registered, understand that this has to end, and it ends by people voting out or voting for change. And now's the time. Now's the time you start. You don't wait for the election.
Look, this is complicated. It's very complicated. You're exactly right. You have people on both sides strategically saying this is good for me. When the Gang of Four, or whatever you want to call them, the squad, talks about democratic socialism, that Trump thinks is the ticket to his winning again. When the House of Representatives votes democratically, not on the basis of who these four are, but the idea of go back where you came from, they are hoping exactly what you've just said, that there will be a massive registration, because if every Democrat in the United States were to vote you would have a Democratic Senate, you'd have a Democratic House, I don't care what the gerrymander looks like, and you would have a Democratic president. But the way that it's always worked is that Republicans register in larger numbers percentage-wise than Democrats do. And what I think Pelosi's genius is here is that they are saying, we know what it's like if you're Italian or Jewish or anybody to say, go back where you came from. We know what that is. If that energizes the base, that Democratic base, to sign up, then you really got something going for the Democrats. But if the idea is that Trump is going to continue with this democratic socialism stuff, that's going to hurt.
So let me ask you a question, Alan, before we go to the rest of the group, just because 187 House members, as I mentioned, Republicans, mostly white men, voted against this measure. Yeah. So will a simple question to you, do you think that, any of those representatives will live to regret that vote after Election Day 2020?
Could be.
Because all those districts are not as slam dunks as others.
They're all going to burn in hell. Because this is not complicated. This is not complicated. I disagree with you on that, Alan, although your analysis is correct. He went too far. And it's really easy for anyone, Republican or Democrat, to say, whoa, that's it. Yeah, I get what he was getting at. He wanted to go after those progressives who have said mean things about America, but he did it the wrong way. That would have been easy to do, and they did not. And it was painful to listen to Republicans on TV last night defending their pro-vote, because there's no reason to vote for that. What he said was wrong and racist, the things we all teach our children not to do.
So you don't think anybody is going to regret that? Any of those 187 will regret that in 2020?
You couldn't vote that way and not even be thinking about what you're going to think.
Yeah, but
in
what
the
if they're voted? Do you think anyone will be voted out?
No, I do not. I think we have a racist country, and this was proof of it.
I don't think it's proof of a racist country, but I think by the Election Day 2020, this would be kind of long forgotten. We've had a few of these kind of moments where we've thought, well, this is where everything really changes.
And it doesn't.
Yeah, it's
It's another brick on the road.
It's another brick, but there have been so many at this point. I don't think that this will be a defining issue in the election in 2020. I will point out, though, that it's interesting that many of those, or almost all of those same Republicans, voted for the resolution condemning Ilhan Omar for her bigoted tweets.
Right.
So there's clearly a double standard there.
That's what the issue is here. Can Pelosi successfully define what is going on as being anti-American without supporting what the four, who she disagrees with, by the way, because she thinks that they're going to mess up the middle America purple districts where they won the House of Representatives? Can she win by identifying go back where you came from as the issue, as opposed to democratic socialism?
Well, Trump is betting on that too. He agrees with Pelosi that's what they represent, and that's why he wants to bring it to the forefront. But he did it in a most unconscionable way.
But he did it knowing what it
was. Way over the line.
But Rosemary, he did it knowing what he was doing. He was appealing to the devil in everybody's psyche. That's what he was doing, and he knew what he was doing, and that makes him doubly reprehensible. And by the way, Rosemary, I don't think we disagree on this a bit.
Yeah, we're just saying it in different ways. I don't even blame. Well,
it makes good radio,
him.
So keep it going.
Okay,
so.
I do blame Trump, and it's easy to do that, but it's much worse than that. When Mark Sanford is defending Trump, he goes, "Well, I'll tell you that it's weird," and Chris Cuomo goes to him on TV last night. Weird is not racist. Say that the statement was racist. Well, no, I'm agreeing with you. It's weird. Those are not the same. It's awful.
I agree. It's definitely awful, but at the same time, it's sort of like there's a little bit of empathy that I had with the chair who just threw down the gavel yesterday and was like, I abandoned the chair because, you know, listen, I am a brown woman who is often the only person who looks like me in a lot of places. I've been called names that you use derogatory towards women. I've been called names, been called the N-word. I've been called all sorts of stuff. Like, racism happens. But I think this whole issue really detracts from like so many other things that that need to be done in a time where, like, yes, you do need to call him up, but we've been calling him up since the beginning. We've had racist presidents in office before, but it doesn't detract from it doesn't change what ultimately happens in history. You know, there are issues, there were immigration policies that happened, you know, back with Calvin Coolidge, for example, and the 1924 Immigration Act, where he was using this almost very similar rhetoric and, you know, still sent, you know, put a 2% cap on people coming to our country inequitably. And that was the bigger issue. But because, again, I just think there is more work that can be done than spending so much media attention and so much time on debating this issue that's already known.
Yeah, but if I could jump in, one part of this that I think that's very important for our listeners to think about is, what's the definition of patriotic? Mm-hmm. You know, this jingoism about, you know, love it or leave it, and certainly it harkens back to the Vietnam period and earlier. But this idea that you can't question the country or question government because you're now unpatriotic. But the far right, you start to think about Oath Keepers, you start to think about Bundy, you think about what's happening with the protests on use of public land in the West. You know, there's a hypocrisy here. They question government and they question the country, they're patriots. When anybody else questions and says, how do we make this country better, then therefore they're not patriotic. That's dangerous.
And one of the ironies is that one of the shocking things or surprising things about the 2016 campaign was the way that Trump himself talked about the country. You know, he gave his American Carnage speech and he called the country a hellhole, and he told black people that things couldn't get any worse for them, or whatever phrasing he used. I mean, he ran the country down, and I know that people do that as part of a campaign. You're always going to try to say that things aren't great as you try to become president. But, you know, his language was unusually harsh for a candidate. And it's ironic to have him flipping now and saying that anybody who criticizes the country is unpatriotic.
I agree so much with Jen, and yet fundamentally disagree that you have to take the long historical look at this. I really think that's wrong, that this is not a distraction from Epstein or from impeachment or all the other issues that you might name. This was one thing he did that was blatantly wrong. And we should be calling him out on it, and so should the other politicians. It's not normal.
One of the other things, yesterday in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, he had the Trump for Women for Trump had their kickoff yesterday. And Guilfoyle, what's her name? Kimberly Guilfoyle?
Yeah, Donnie Jr.'s babe.
Yeah, so she was the star attraction. But we've had a couple of letters just this morning about the misogyny of this too. Of the four people that he went after, there was the racist element, but there was also there were four women. So he won. In suburban Philadelphia. He wasn't supposed to, but he won in 2016 in suburban Philadelphia because white women voted for him. Will this have any impact on that? As my mic flags. Yes, go ahead.
No, I don't think so. I mean, like you said, it's another brick on the wall in the big pile, but this alone, no, I don't think so.
I hate that I agree with you, but yes. Yeah, I mean, go out on
the news cycle. We have no idea what's going to come at us in the next however many months. I mean, there could be world events. There are all sorts of things that will influence the election. But this will be just another thing that we'll look back on and say, God.
You have to, even looking at Trump's been a public figure for decades now, and we know what he said. We know what he said about the exonerated five. We know what he said about women. We know what he said about so many people. He still got into office. No one's any more protected from racism or hate crimes, which is even worse, or rape or sexual assault, since, you know, we are enlightened by this rhetoric. But again, there's nothing protecting people.
It would have been so easy to vote in favor of this. It had no teeth. It was just like saying you went too far. It's a reprimand. It's so easy, and they couldn't even do that.
Alan? So I want to know from particularly the women on the panel, because I have such great respect for them. Uh-oh. Is What did you say something, Rosemary?
I said, so, uh-oh.
No, my issue is, has the misogyny, which is so clearly there, has that, and has been there, has that changed women's votes in America? And I think I heard at least Rosemary say no. Is that right?
We were talking specifically about white women in suburbia who supported
okay,
Trump.
Okay, I'll take it. Okay, I'll take it.
I think that Trump's whole time in office has energized women to protest, to run for office, to go out and make an effort at least on the local level, and it's moving upward. But changing fundamental Republican women's votes, I'm not seeing that.
Will change now? In other words, will white suburban women change? And there's been
black women always been right.
They've been changing since 2016. I mean, I don't know what the situation was in suburban Philadelphia, but in suburban Albany, we saw areas that are traditionally suburban areas that are traditionally very red go blue, like Clifton Park and places like that.
Right.
And you saw that again in 2018. So I don't think this particular incident will influence that, but you've been seeing women, suburban women, leaving in disgust for 3 years now, and that will certainly continue, I think.
So what was it, Chris, that made suburban white women, forget about black women in this particular case, what is it that made those women vote for Trump?
Well, you're generalizing. I don't think
they
all did.
We have 10 seconds.
I think a lot of them are Republicans.
So also,
it's as simple as that.
Yeah, they vote Republican.
Could be.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your comments. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you all with us. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Jen Smith, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin all on the program this morning, and we are very happy to have you. Panel at WAMC.org. Just before we go on, I did want to, while we were talking about the impact that this perhaps would have on the election with various voting blocks. NBC released a tape this morning showing Donald Trump at a party in Mar-a-Lago in 1992 with Jeffrey Epstein. Of all people, they were talking, pointing, and apparently admiring, I think is probably the nicest word I could use, women. There is a scene where he is kind of getting a little grabby. So I don't know. It doesn't certainly seem to me to be any worse than the compared to the Access Hollywood tape. It seems tame.
It's just locker room talk. Come on.
But you add it again. I would keep using this term, but you know, you add another brick. And at what point do the wheels break?
Well, and you know, you think back to what's acceptable to be president, and this is behavior that we wouldn't have accepted from Obama, either of the Bushes,
or from Bill Clinton.
But that's that's the third time we've said that this morning, which basically, so he can get away with anything, right?
He said it.
Yeah, he said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and his base and that's scary.
So it isn't his base that we have to be looking at. It's the Democratic base. Now we do know that in the case of Obama, right, the black population in America turned out in support. Is there anything that anybody sees here that will make that happen again right now? If Kamala Harris, for example, runs for president, will that same turnout occur? Or what is it that will make that happen?
It's not necessarily about black or white anymore. I think it's really becoming kind of archaic. I think there are things culturally in terms of cultural conservatism or progressive values that really motivate. It's really, I think, about values and issues that personally matter to people that will, you know, cause them to to vote the way they vote. I think it's naive to say that, you know, like you look at my own race. I'm the same race as Nikki Haley. I would not vote there or act the way the same way she did. You can't just lump all one people into the same voting habits.
But we can tell demographically that that African-Americans turned out in larger numbers for Obama than they have historically.
In terms of the ones who are actually motivated to register and vote, I think a lot of people, still a great percentage of that population, aren't registered, aren't actually going to the polls and exercising their rights either.
And, it's hard to replicate what Obama did. The magnetism and the skill that he had politically at will never be repeated, at least not by the candidates that are running right now. But, you know, he was also the first.
Yep.
And that's a big thing. He also ran, compared to where the Democrats are now, is fairly culturally conservative. And I think for a lot of black voters, some black voters have been alienated a little bit by the party's kind of drift leftward on social issues. There are so many factors in play that I think it's a little bit difficult to predict what will really bring people out.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I asked the question.
Yeah. You have to worry about the voters in the middle just as much, too.
Don't
forget about that.
All right, we have letters, many of them, actually. Let's go to Mary, who says, Elise Stefanik stood with the Republican men by not voting to censor Trump for his racist tweets. I understand that she believes the tweets were inappropriate, but not racist. I believe the reason she voted with these white men was because these were the men who gave her the seat in the 21st District, and regardless of how she feels about what the president said, she needs to stand with them or risk political suicide.
Well, you've got to decide whether your personal courage and morals is worth more than your seat. And
she never has. She's always been an opportunist. She votes the way she has to politically.
Well, but that's very Republican, I think, right now.
Not admirable, though, at all.
Well, let me just say that the reporters will all tell you that these Republicans, the senators and the congressmen, are disgusted with the president. But they haven't got the guts. They don't have the profile and courage in them to make the difference, and she's just another example of that.
Alan, can we get you a little closer to your microphone?
Absolutely.
Does this
sound a little bit better?
It does. It does. Oh, yeah. We don't want to miss a word.
Okay.
All right, maybe Rosemary.
And I don't blame you for that. Why are you laughing, Rosemary?
No reason.
Roger says, the silence of Republican Party on Trump's overt misogyny and racism is deafening. Only a handful supported a censure against the president for his lies and insulting comments. This reveals that a once respected conservative political party has been largely hijacked by those for those whom misogyny and racism are acceptable. Linda from Hurley says the Republican focus in life is money. As long as the market is booming, they will continue to support Trump no matter what he tweets. How can anyone be surprised about this after opening their quarterly statements?
Well, that's right. And it's not only Republicans, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason that Trump may win the election, the next election, the reason that political analysts are saying is that the market is standing firm, is very helpful to many middle class Americans. So it's not only Republicans.
Which, as we have established in earlier conversations, that annoys Rosemary.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, despite what the letter writer says. I'm appalled, and those are different emotions.
Dixie writes, instead of spending so much print and airspace on Trump, I wish the media would focus on all the bills that have been passed in the House. These bills are concerned with taking care of the country's actual needs. Of course, McConnell won't bring them up in the Senate, so the general public will not be aware that the Dems have been working while the Republicans have been blocking good government.
Well, I wanted to ask you about this, Alan.
One of the things that we get a lot of letters saying like that, ignore Trump. Don't do a thing that he is. Don't talk about anything that he's saying and the rest of it. And I wish the media would concentrate on what the House of Representatives has done. Ladies and gentlemen, we do it, and we do it all the time. It's on our news broadcast. We talk about it. So the idea that somehow you found out about it, but that everybody else doesn't know because the media isn't covering it, that's a little difficult for me.
Listen to me, why are you appalled? I didn't understand that.
He was saying, why are you surprised that people are standing up, Republicans are standing up for Trump? All they really care about is money. I'm not surprised by that at all. Of course it's
no, I was saying you established earlier that you were by the markets that everyone says the markets are good, it's okay, so anything else can happen.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge mistake, though, if Democrats start sounding like they don't care about the economy or they don't care about bread and butter issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that we can debate about how responsible Trump is for it, is for all this, but the poverty rate is falling, the participation rate.
Unemployment. All the figures are good, and I don't discount that.
They're especially good for kind of marginalized parts of the country, and that's all extraordinarily important. And if Democrats negate all that, I think that they're going to sound tone deaf.
You don't have to be racist and antagonistic and misogynistic to do all of those things. That's not a requirement for the economic good that he's done, although I would dispute some of that.
Absolutely.
His tax bill is horrible, and the debt is increasing, and there's all kinds of other problems. But grant that people overall are looking good and unemployment is down, even though it's two jobs rather than one, blah, blah, blah. But you could do all of that without saying the kind of stuff he's saying. And he should be called out for that.
Absolutely.
He doesn't think so. But he's the president of the United States, and he got there by being a racist misogynist.
But it's not realistic to think that people shouldn't factor in the economy as their— I mean, the presidents get too much blame and too much credit for the economy.
Yeah.
But,
right.
I mean, we Americans have always factored that in, and of course they're going to do that in 2020.
Right. No, I don't blame him for taking credit. I know that if it were reversed and Obama weren't, he would be getting credit for it. It's just the way life is. So I give that to him.
Well, Trump would still be looking for his birth certificate, but that's a different issue. But, you know, Chris, this gets back to the earlier conversation. The Democrats are going to have to address the economy as part of their platform. You know, you hit it on the head. Is that
not as part of their platform? It should be the centerpiece. Just the economy, but bread and, you know,
the bread and butter issues. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think what, you know, we get back to the question of what happened in the suburban vote in 2016. I thought their message was weak, and they didn't have their finger on the pulse of the people, and they really need to keep the pulse there.
Mm-hmm. Or their message was weak because it was realistic, and Trump just told lies. I'm bringing back coal. I'm bringing back manufacturing. Everything's going to be great. No one's ever going to leave the country again. He lied. And Hillary gave all these, you know, like, oh,
no,
we're going to have to retrain coal
miners. Hillary's message seemed to be it's her turn. You know, that it didn't—
the media's interpretation of it.
Well, her slogan was, I'm with her.
I'm
going to do something for you. It's I'm with her. That it was about her. Instead of what she could do for people. And I think that was a fatal flaw.
And I think everybody, including Trump, thought that he didn't have a chance.
Right.
I mean, did that make
a
difference?
I wish that were true, yeah.
Bernie says the left are eating their own. It seems the Republicans will follow their candidate no matter what. Trump can say whatever he wants, and still the majority of Republicans will follow him. The Dems split themselves into tiny blue sections and then divide the vote so no one gets a majority. This is how the Republicans win. Yep. What should the Dems do? When will they put aside their relatively minor differences and understand they must win an election first in order to move their agenda forward?
Absolutely. If you heard Kamala this morning debating via television with Joe Biden, I was shaking my head and I'm saying they're both basically saying the same thing, and yet this is supposed to be what is going to help either of them win in the primaries. I didn't get it, and I think the letter writer is profound.
Well, the ironic thing about the Trump tweets is that the Democrats were infighting. It was getting really kind of I know you think it was a manufactured issue, Rosemary, but it was getting kind of nasty over the weekend. And he obliterated all that, and he unified the Democrats. I mean, it was
want to be president.
All right, Adam says one of your participants casually referred to Omar's famed comments as bigoted, as if that is fact. Omar's comments questioning right-wing Israeli lobbyist was not bigoted but nuanced and then framed as bigoted. Trump is making the U.S. less safe for American Jews like me and Netanyahu by being chummy with Trump rather than calling him out is complicit.
What do you think, Chris?
I think some of her tweets in the past have been a little bit bigoted, for sure. I mean, it's all about the Benjamins. Certainly plays to the Jewish, financial stereotypes, and saying that Israel has hypnotized the world kind of plays to other tropes that have been used in history. I don't, you know, that vote in the House was overwhelming, and she wasn't named specifically in that vote, so it was a little bit different than the one that happened yesterday, but I think she deserved to be called out for it, and she apologized for it.
And I think that makes the difference, right? I mean, that's the difference. She acknowledged that, you know,
she went too far.
She went too far, and that's something we won't see. And no, I don't think any vote that was made yesterday, because there's no repercussion behind it. It's not like, you know, if you have bad sportsmanship in the NBA or something, you get a fine. You get suspended from games. That doesn't happen in politics. So until you actually take action for calling out someone for doing something that we, you know, people vote and say that's wrong, where we think these comments are wrong, but nothing's going to happen. So he's going to keep saying things.
Well, he even the way he spins it is just remarkable to me. The media saying, oh, this is embarrassing to him, even though it has.
I think it's embarrassing to everyone.
But the way he's spinning it, Jen, is look at that, 187 Republicans, almost solid support behind me. That's great.
Well, and that's what his strategy will always be, is to spin it in his own favor. But again, it
Republicans allowed that.
And you know, it detracts and it creates this division within the party. When, you know, the beginning of this term, you know, Democrats were seemingly all on the same page about health care. That was their one element of moving forward and being unified. And, you know, that's long gone.
Yeah. Let's take one last comment, yes, though. I think it's really dangerous, though, to link support for Israel to a specific party. And that's what we're starting to see. And I think it's well within our rights to question some of the things that are occurring in Israel, the development and occupied properties. That doesn't mean you're anti-Israel.
No, absolutely not. And I think it kind of echoes what Rosemary was saying earlier about the economy. You can have a good economy and not have racist tweets. You can criticize Israel without slipping into kind of old tropes about I mean, there's plenty to criticize there.
The panel's starting to agree with each other, so let's take a break and try to screw that up.
So sure.
We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back. Listening to the Turbines playing Music Haven Concert Series tonight at Proctor's in Schenectady. Normally they would play outside, but because of the rain, they're playing inside. So there you go. Musichavenstage.org to find out more and to see their great schedule. They have really cool world music throughout the summer season. So that is happening tonight. We go back to the letters. Michael says, as despicable as what Trump said, I partially agree with Jen Smith in that it is a distraction. And it had to be a big distraction because it's a distraction from Epstein, who most certainly knows a lot of dirty secrets about Trump and his Mar-a-Lago buddies. Chances are Trump is covering for others like Epstein. And that from Michael. Sarah says, I think the issue of suburban white women, it is not what will make them change their vote. Rather, it is what will make them come out to vote. Many did not vote in 2016. Alan says, yes, it matters, the House vote. Even if it does nothing, what it does is put people's posture on the record for which history shall judge them.
P.S. That's Alan the writer, Joe, not Alan the Alan.
That is correct. That is Alan the writer. That is Alan from somewhere. And he says, P.S., great music this morning. Bob says, not our Bob, but another Bob. This Bob is from Schenectady. Donnie's racist tirade is just a distraction from being named in the Epstein suit, I guess, to our SPOTUS, sexual predator of the United States. It's better to be seen as a blatant racist than as a child rapist.
Wow.
Steve writes, if you don't condemn this, you condone this language. Even a cheap book has a spine, is his subject line.
Ooh.
And encourage it to both continue and get worse. He is the president, and we hold those in that office to a much higher public standard. It's not just another brick. It's a bad foundation. Jim says, good morning, panel. Donald Trump has now ripped away whatever thin veneer remained concealing the deep racism within the Republican Party. When Trump is finally gone, there will be a flood of Trump wannabes. Moderate Republican candidates won't have a chance in the primaries, even with their dog whistles. This mess will be with us for a long time to come.
I agree with that statement. I think Trump has fundamentally changed American politics, and there's going to have to be a seismic shift to bring back some level of civility. He's brought the WWE or whatever they call it, the World Wrestling Federation style to the White House.
It was World Wrestling Federation, and then the World Wildlife Federation.
Yes, I was
sued them, and then as the World Wrestling Entertainment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's similar to Berlusconi, who scarred Italy, and long after he's gone, the level of discourse, the acceptance of corruption, the just incompetence in government continues. So, yay for America. Look what we have to look forward to.
And yet, Rosemary, they kept electing the guy. I mean, they knew. I was in Italy. They were laughing at him, and they were slapping their knees.
Oh, ho, ho, ho. He likes young girls. Yeah.
Right.
Sexism is not restricted to the U.S.
Beverly says, as a woman of color, I join my voice with your panelists in saying this flare-up around racism is not going to change history. It's a distraction. Obstruction of justice is where Democrats have traction and our strongest historical charge. Come on, people. Use your outside voice. Let every media hear you chanting, lock him up. Lawrence in Stone Ridge writes, you've been debating a lot this morning about which blocks will or won't vote for Trump in 2020. What about the blocks of people who may stay home and not vote in 2020? Maybe because they feel that their votes won't count or will be irrelevant.
I guarantee you that the strategists are out there, the Democratic strategists, no matter what you say, the Democratic strategists are out there, the Republican strategists are out there. They have a Jewish desk. They have an Italian desk. They have a African-American desk. I know it. I mean, I've talked to them again and again about this, and that's the way elections are won or lost. And if you don't like it, well, then, you know, dispute it, but and join the lumpen proletariat.
Well, I think Trump's strategy, too, will be to kind of hopefully to depress the vote. I think he's going to try to make whoever the Democrats nominate seem as unappealing and as awful as
absolutely
as people see him. And that will, you know, he's hoping that it'll be a base election and that he can squeak it out like he did the last time.
Yep.
All right. We have just a few minutes before the top of the hour break. One of the stories that we have is that Justice John Paul Stevens passed away. He was 99 years old, and he 35 years he spent on the U.S. Supreme Court transformed him improbably from a Republican antitrust lawyer into an outspoken leader of the court's liberal wing. He died Tuesday at a Florida hospital. Again, he was 99. The cause was complications of a stroke he suffered the day before, according to the Supreme Court. When he retired in 2010, at the age of 90, Justice Stevens was the second oldest and second longest living serving justice ever to sit on the court. Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. was about 8 months older when he retired in 1932. William Douglas had served 36 years, 1939 to 1975. Think about that.
Yeah, he said he stammered and lost his place when reading his very strong dissent on the Gore decision, and that's when he decided that he had to go.
He's an interesting character. He's a towering intellect, and I love the fact that he was described as slightly quirky loner. He owned it, and I think he reflected a time where we put intellects on the Supreme Court who really understood the law and the Constitution, and they were allowed to adapt and change rather than go in with some sort of litmus test that they've got to follow their entire careers.
That's the profound point.
And
that's
as he exactly pointed right. out, Kavanaugh is not one of those kind of judges.
Mm-hmm. No.
He likes beer.
He does like beer, yeah.
Yeah, and he spoke out on Kavanaugh when
nobody else
was.
Very controversially, yeah. Yes. It was good. It's good. My my son called and was talking about this, and I said, actually, you know, as long as it's not a current judge, I'm not that interested in the story. And he chastised me and said, this was a national treasure, Mom. So
yeah.
He's right. Yeah. And then I went back guiltily and read everything.
But I think the earlier point is correct, which is it's changed. Right now, at least in the Republican camp, the idea is you only put people on who are going to be, you know, get in line and do exactly what they're supposed to do. Now, Roberts is an interesting case in that he wants the court to have a little bit of respect, and he's doing some things about that, including the Obamacare vote, which saved Obamacare.
I think it's also important that we honor and recognize the commitment of people to public service, particularly people that don't necessarily serve in the military, because it seems to be the only group right now that gets recognized for service to the community. Mm-hmm. The courts have really taken a hit. And when you have someone who is such a decent human being and a great American, we really do need to take a moment to recognize the, wow, the multiple decades of service to this country.
And I think his era of service, though, is so profoundly different than, yep, than now, and you know, I think that was what Alan was talking about too, and I think he said in his memoirs that it wasn't his opinions that had changed; it was the world around him and the makeup of the court, which has, you know, definitely moved away from the kind of values and the kind of thinking that he represented and the language that he used.
I'm kind of wrapped up in elder issues right now, so the fact that he was producing such high quality, amazing work well into his 90th, his 90s is really of interest to me. I mean, there was a man who kept it up and never lost it. That's
And he was a pretty mean ping pong.
Yeah, exactly.
I loved that April interview with Nina Totenberg. That was awesome.
Alan,
but the other guy to look at here, which nobody wants to apparently, is Gerald Ford. Now, Ford, you know, appointed him. And a lot of people said, you know, Eisenhower was supposed to have said about Earl Warren the worst decision that he had ever made in his life and the rest of it. But Ford appointed this guy.
And he said it was the best decision.
And when people were saying, you did a bad thing, the Republicans were saying you did a bad thing, he's saying, no, this is my proudest achievement of being president. Now, that's interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Real presidents. I remember those days.
All right, let's take a break. We will be back. Ray Graff with news right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And to Act 3, we welcome our incredible panel, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Jen Smith, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. You know, a picture is worth a thousand words, and I will say that obviously photos don't work well on the radio. But there's this great picture in the Washington Post this morning of Jared Kushner getting ready to talk about the White House immigration plan, what they refer to as an immigration update on the Great Immigration Act of 2019. And there he is, and there's a TV set, and he sort of looks, as my father would have said, a bullfighter who dropped his sword. But it's a great picture. And anyway, they were all ready to go with this plan and to talk about it and to move it into the public conversation. Well, that didn't go very well, because then over the weekend, the president made his remarks regarding the racist remarks demanding four minority Democratic lawmakers go back to the countries from which they came. So then the White House, prepared to roll out the plan, decided, maybe we won't do that. Maybe we'll hold off. And so they've decided to postpone it now. And they're going to wait a while and see. But the ongoing controversy of the comments got in the way of the White House's initial plans as a late afternoon meeting with a half dozen congressional Republican leaders on the administration's new immigration bill was abruptly postponed amid the drawn out fight on the floor of the House as lawmakers debated condemning Trump's racist tweets. That interruption Tuesday is far from the only obstacle the White House will face this year as it tries to generate momentum for its new immigration plan, which aims to reorient the current legal immigration system to one based primarily on an immigrant's ability to contribute to the economy rather than on family ties.
So I love the picture, and I look at the bust of Benjamin Franklin that's
right
in the
behind
picture,
him.
And I would ask our viewers or our listeners to actually put the bubble of what Benjamin is thinking about, because he's both scowling and puzzled at what Jared is saying. So, I mean, it's a multicultural issue.
Joe, I have one little objection to the way the Times – is it the Times article?
The Washington Post.
Washington Post you're reading. Return to the country from which they've come is very different from when you say, go back where you came from, which could mean a lot of different things.
Well, it was the quote. The quote was from his tweet, and it was go back from to the countries from which they came.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm not seeing your point, Al. Yeah. You think he's saying that very different?
He thinks the article is softening what Trump
I see. Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, and the Trump supporters are actually saying that. They're saying that Trump wasn't saying to go back to the countries. They're saying go back to their communities.
Go back from whence
you came.
Yeah.
Well, I will
say. Communities rather than countries.
I will say, right. I mean, they're quoting what he said in the first tweet. But when he quote unquote doubled down the next day, mm-hmm. that's exactly what he said is go back from where you came from.
Yeah, right. Well, he knows what he's doing. He thinks that's the way to win the election.
All right. So where does the immigration plan go from here?
Nowhere. It's dead on arrival. And you know, they didn't even talk to the Republicans, let alone the Democrats. And frankly, anything that Jared touches seems to turn to crap. I got to tell you, it's the worst form of nepotism in my mind. But here's a gentleman who has very few life experiences, pretty much failed in business. So let's put him in charge of the most important issues around the world, like world peace and
Middle Eastern relations.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
I want to know how many of those 620 pages are blank because they just had no clue of what they were doing or what it replicated. You know, again, the sort of merit-based thing, that's old policy too. That again comes from the 20s and earlier on in our country's history. So, you know, we know that didn't really change things. So really I'm more concerned about what they're going to actually do with.
I would like
Jen, as a professor, I think there's probably at least 400 pages of charts, graphs, and pictures, and he probably has a hand-drawn cover as well on this.
I would like to borrow from the Trump campaign one of the wisdoms that they offered us, but this time about Trump and his son-in-law, which is lock them up.
Yeah. Well, and senior Republicans are more skeptical of the plan's fate. One GOP senator said, I don't think there's any chance that we have any bandwidth to do this. While a senior Republican aide said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell does not intend to, quote, waste time on legislation that has little chance of garnering the necessary 60 votes to advance in the Senate. So in other words, this is akin to a parent giving their child a pot and a wooden spoon and putting them in a room in the White House and let them
be best.
Another big
campaign that went nowhere.
Not a pot and a wooden spoon. Usually you give them quieter toys.
Does anybody else
want to be bothered.
Does anybody else think McConnell's in trouble? I do.
No.
He seems like he's in trouble.
I think he's in trouble. There's a tremendous amount of money that is coming in for him. I'm told that he's not a popular man in Kentucky.
Sure.
And so wouldn't that be something?
And Amy McGrath is doing really well and not only getting money from her state, but also from around the country, where it's just pouring in.
But that hurt you. That's hurt.
Yeah, that was true of Beto O'Rourke too. And you know, he came close, but it didn't matter in the end.
Well, yeah, but he came close, which is something that one would not have expected in Texas, right?
I don't know why Democrats get so off on that. Coming close is losing. It's the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you rather come close, Rosemary, or would you rather be football fields behind?
It makes no difference.
It makes a huge difference. It shows progress. It shows that you're getting somewhere. It shows you're getting closer, as opposed to being way back and hopeless.
I don't know. He still turns around and goes,
I suppose if I was going to lose an election, I'd rather not be George McGovern or Walter Mondale. Coming close is a little bit more uplifting, isn't it?
Which is why I read you in the Times Union all the time. You're a profound person.
Yeah. Yep. That's what everybody says.
When we're off air, we say that all the time.
Yep.
Very profound.
Yeah. Very, very profound.
That's how you have to introduce the next week's show.
I'm going to rename my columns Profundity. Yeah.
All right. This is a story that's been going on for a while, and we haven't addressed it, and I think it's been going on for almost a week, and I want to address it, which is what's going on as screwed up as the leadership of the NRA is, of what's going on there, which we have addressed. Planned Parenthood is having a lot of problems. They have ousted their president. They are seeking a more political approach, and there seems to be great discord within the higher echelons of the organization. Planned Parenthood on Tuesday removed its president after less than a year on the job, seeking new leadership at a time when abortion rights have come under increasing attack from state houses and Republicans in Washington. The sudden ouster reflected a widening disagreement between the president, Leanna Wen, and the board of directors over her management style and which direction to steer one of the nation's leading women's reproductive rights groups. Her departure followed a series of negotiations that appear to end acrimoniously on Tuesday. This from the New York Times. In a Twitter post, Dr. Wen said her fate had been decided at a secret meeting, which the organization disputed. She later issued a statement saying she was leaving because the new board chairs and I have philosophical differences over the direction and the future of Planned Parenthood.
Do we know what those differences were? I mean, that's not as specific as I would have liked to see. In other words, what was she doing?
Dr. Wen wanted to turn abortion into a health care debate. She wanted to make women's reproductive health a matter of health and public health rather than politics. Mm-hmm. And the whole dispute, Jen, actually reminds me of disagreements that we have, that basically we're the same, but you always take the long view. I think she's absolutely right, that that's the smart way to do it. It's the way to end division among or between women's groups and bring everybody together on we all need to be concerned about abortion and cool the temperature. However, after coming after Cecile Richards, who was intensely and very effectively used the political system, and to be here at a time when 9 states have now passed abortion restrictions, I think she was doomed. I think they do need an activist and a loudmouth and someone who can raise a lot of money and go after them.
And I think that was the part of her leaving anyway. She was planning a departure anyways because of these philosophical differences. She's a physician. And I think, you know, if you look at the Planned Parenthood of, you know, 2 decades ago, it was a very different organization. It was about health. It was about get your free HIV screenings, get sliding scale fees for contraception, prevent HIV, AIDS.
Exactly.
And I think, again, because of the way abortion has been politicized, the organization absolutely wants to put their teeth in it and not let go into what they're believing in.
Yeah, and it's
I don't want to start trouble. I don't want to start trouble here. But yesterday, I thought I heard an utterance or words is a better word. From Rosemary, that she said, when it comes down to it, I believe that abortion is murder. Did you say that?
I did. I mean, that I was raised Catholic. My mother is horrified.
But you
by
believe it.
It.
Okay. So
I do.
How does this debate affect you and the way you see this?
The debate over Wen's leadership?
Over leadership, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it does. As I say, I think in the long term, she's correct that we have to get over this idea that that the media, and we promote this, that you either believe in abortion or you don't. There's a whole continuum. There are plenty of people who believe it's horrible, but you don't get to choose on other women. And then there are others who believe that this is such a fundamental issue of life and death that society has to weigh in on it. Those positions are all acceptable. They're all arguable. This is not like Trump and his people. These are all reasonable, but the debate has become so partisan that it's vicious. And I think Wen got caught up in it.
So how does it affect you, Rosemary? Because you have a basic, as you said, raised Catholic belief. Yeah. But I take it you still believe
strongly choice. Strongly choice. That's a we see that position among a lot of Catholic lawmakers. And I
including
think that
Joe Biden until
Joe
Biden,
until
recently,
and who the vice presidential candidate for Hillary was also very strongly Catholic and doesn't believe in
abortion.
Well,
Mario Cuomo.
And Mario, yeah, exactly. But I think that she had to go. As Jen said, this she doesn't dispute that. There was really a difference. I think Planned Parenthood has to be an advocacy agency, and that means they got to play smart politics. They're clearly under attack. Not personally because they're a company, but specifically Republicans are going after their funding, not all groups, not everybody who commits, who does abortions, only this group.
And that's where I have to compliment Planned Parenthood, though. It's really hard to follow a charismatic leader anyway. And
right.
If you think about organizational change,
right.
the most of the people who were in the organization under Richards have left. So they have huge vacuums there. They recognize that the leadership wasn't where the organization needs to go, and they actually had the strength and thoughtfulness to make a move sooner rather than later.
Right.
And when you don't have the right fit at the top, especially given all the pressures that Rosemary said, it's better to make a change now than to be another year into this and have more lasting damage to the organization.
And I think the reason why it made news is sort of just the tweet about there being a quote-unquote secret meeting to kind of make this decision more expedited, if you will. But I think, you know, in this case, both the board and Dr. Nguyen had seen this change happening. And
yeah.
I think it will be a challenge for the new interim head to kind of say, okay, this is the bar of expectation. This is what I have to be. And then, you know, she has to decide if she's ready to do that.
I think that the situation politically has gotten so acute with what happened this past, in the past few months, that there will be clear direction from the board on what they want and what has to be done. So,
what would you do, Rosemary, what would you do? I mean, if you were the new president of the organization, what would you personally do in terms of leadership?
March on the state houses in Virginia and Georgia and Alabama, maybe. I think that there's a lot that can be done as far as communication about I would use some of Dr. Nguyen's ideas that this is a health issue. We have to lower the temperature of this debate. And I would be appealing to evangelicals. Which no one has. Everybody's ceding them to Trump.
Bob?
No, it's really interesting. Would have thought that you turn the temperature up a little bit.
And I think that's what they're going to do.
Marching.
I think their plan is to turn it up and become a more intense organization. And in some respects, following the path that the NRA took, you know, and becoming more. I mean, the Planned Parenthood has always been a political organization. I mean, their PAC donates millions and millions of dollars to candidates, and you know that part of it shouldn't be forgotten. It's not like they're making a sudden turn into politics.
No,
but I think their plan is to really ratchet up the heat and not turn down the heat.
I like that, and that's why I say march on state houses. I mean, this is and it's going to go to the Supreme Court. There's much work to be done both legally and politically.
What will they do at the court?
Probably file friends of the court briefs.
Amicus briefs. Mm.
Yes, I know that, but what do you think the final ruling will be? Do you think that, you know, that
we have a horrible Supreme Court. I'm not hopeful.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, and what gets lost with the Planned Parenthood to me, though, is all of the other work that they do. And I think that's something that Dr. Nguyen was trying to raise is that the whole issue of inadequate health care
for poor women
and
young people too.
Right. And they've been painted as just sort of an abortion organization, and it's such a small part of what they do. And as they defund and as the Trump administration and some of these states defund the Planned Parenthood, you have to ask where do people go for health care? And where as a country do we think we should have access to?
But part of that defunding is because they have become a political organization, right? I mean, say that you're a Republican congressman and Planned Parenthood is giving to your opponent every election cycle. I mean, doesn't that kind of add to your desire to defund them and to weaken the organization?
But here's my problem, though, Chris. Is that
there's a risk in becoming political is what I'm saying.
True, but at the same time is that you don't shut down clinics when you have nothing else available. And this is sort of a burnt earth policy that's taken that is going to cost people their lives, and nobody seems to be talking about that in Missouri and Alabama and some of these places.
And I think that's part of it, though, is because I think that work is tied. What Planned Parenthood also did was provide sliding scale fees for people who didn't have insurance, and it becomes an insurance issue, and that's something we've politically and socially been, you know, lax on and arguing, you know, better insurance rates. I mean, the things that we cover and don't cover here, and the amount of money people pay out of pocket or just to pay in insurance fees is astronomical in this country.
Yeah, but Chris, I think your comment is spot on, though, that in my mind, the Planned Parenthood is just as prominent and political as the NRA.
But on the other hand, how's the NRA doing these days? Not too good.
No, and we've seen the same articles about them and the problems of their leadership. I would go on record saying is that I don't believe that anybody in Planned Parenthood is taking money for trips and
they have
outfits
a lot of fiscal
and
issues.
that Lapierre has taken.
All right, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody. I know. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll welcome all of you. Rosemary Mayo, see you tomorrow. Thank you very much. Bob Griffin, always good to have you here. Chris Churchill, thank you very much.
Jen
Smith, always a pleasure. Alan, thank you. We will be back with more show after this short break.